Moving prisoners in Florida is a big industry that's lightly regulated, even after a series of deaths and lawsuits. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Marshall Project, a nonpartisan news organization reporting on the U.S. criminal justice system, investigated how private companies oftentimes are called to ship prisoners across state lines. The Marshall Report highlighted prisoner treatment as sometimes being cruel and inhumane. We'll hear from two of the reporters about a lawsuit filed by a prisoner in Broward County. Also, P. Scott Cunningham stops by to talk National Poetry Month and a giant poetic sculpture. And finally, we'll look at a new play called Amparo, created by two women of Cuban descent. It's the story of the Arechabela family and the famous Havana Club rum. But the show is not at a theater, it's at a house. And the audience will decide what story they want to see, like a choose-your-own-adventure play. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Tens of thousands of prisoners are transported across state lines every day. Many of these prisoners are moved using private prison companies, and they face very little oversight. An investigation from the Marshall Project and the New York Times found numerous stories of prisoners getting sick, injured, and in some cases dying while in transit. Prisoners are kept in private vans sometimes, at 10 at a time, with little access to water, food, or medical services. There have been lawsuits filed for female prisoners that were sexually assaulted while en route. Broward County Sheriff's Department contracts with one of these private companies. The company recently settled a lawsuit in Fort Lauderdale for mistreatment of a prisoner. Alicia Santo and Eli Hager reported the story for the Marshall Project. They're joining us now from NPR Studios in New York. Alicia, Eli, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Alicia, let me start with you. Let's get an idea of the scope of the private prison transport industry. How big is it?
It's an industry that's made up of, at this point, as far as we know, two companies. It's a very small industry, and they transport somewhere in the tens of thousands of people range. It's very difficult to know because it's very disjointed. So the way it would normally work is a sheriff's office would have an active warrant for someone, and that person's in another state, and they get pulled over, and that warrant comes up. That sheriff's office could then, rather than go pick up that person in a faraway location, they could contract out the transport for that person to be brought back and face that warrant. It's also used by departments of corrections and prosecutors' offices. So it's used by a variety of law enforcement agencies in order to get people facing charges back to that jurisdiction.
And are they moving people all over the country, or do you tend to see them in specific regions?
They do move people all over the country. We have noticed that there are seem to be a lot of transports headed back to Florida. It's quite difficult to put a number or say, the ratio is this or that. But we have been, we've written and read about transports that have occurred all over the United States.
Eli, explain these contracts with these companies, how they work. How does a sheriff or a police department or a corrections facility decide that they're going to use a private company instead of doing it themselves?
So as Alicia said, a number of local sheriff's offices will have ongoing contracts with one of these private companies. So like, for example, the Broward Sheriff's Office has an ongoing contract with a company called U.S. Corrections to pick up people in other states who are facing warrants back in Broward. But other smaller sheriff's offices, they might do it on a one-time basis. They might go on U.S. Corrections' website and order a transport, essentially, for one person. So it can happen either through contract or individually. And essentially, the decision is based on cost. It would cost an awful lot of money for the Broward Sheriff's Office to go send its deputies out across the country to pick up one person, whereas these companies charge about $1 a mile per prisoner and are able to kind of group prisoners together on a van in a way that's more cost effective.
And that's interesting, you say, because they charge by the mile, and this is one of the reasons you guys pointed out in your report, one of the reasons why they just try to stuff a bunch of people into a van and make the trip as quick as they can.
Right. So that's the business model, essentially, is to get as many people into the van as possible in order to make as much money as possible and then to drive relatively fast in order to pick up more people, and also to drive overnight for days on end in order to, again, pick up more people and make more money. So that's kind of the risks are built into the business model because this ends up causing a lot of crashes and things like that because people are driving overnight and at high speeds.
And the other thing, too, is it could be any kind of prisoner. We're not necessarily talking about prisoners that would be in maximum security, prisoners that have committed really heinous crimes. It could be a mix of all kinds of people. Somebody who just, you know, got caught with, you know, a joint, perhaps, can also be thrown into the same van.
Right. That's one of the things that we've that people have told us is kind of scary about these van trips, because you'll be often on the road for, you know, many days on end, and in a couple of cases, more than a week on end, in one van in a closed space with people who may have committed any range of crimes or have been accused of anything from murder to just not paying child support or a probation violation. Everybody's on there together, and you have women and men on the van together, although they might have a divider, and people are just sitting upright the whole time. With often no seatbelts, and they're just getting thrown around against each other and against the vans, yeah. While they're in shackles, and it's kind of a claustrophobic situation.
This was one of the things, too, that I looking at the pictures, because he had photos of some of these transport vans, and, I mean, within prisons and jails, I mean, there's a protocol on how prisoners are moved from one place to the next, and, of course, there are guards, and the prisoners are shackled, but in these cases, these are private companies. So, and that's why I mentioned before, not a lot of oversight on these companies. Basically, they're just shoving people in there. As you said, no seatbelts. And in some cases, these vans aren't well ventilated.
Right, yeah. The conditions that we've heard from people who have been on the vans and also from people who have filed lawsuits are essentially that they're crammed in together, like I said before, often very poor ventilation or no air conditioning, even in the dead of summer. They often don't stop often enough for bathrooms, so they end up having to urinate in bottles and kind of do that right there on the van in front of each other. And it's kind of always a question how much food or water they're going to get. So it's a pretty miserable situation based on what we've heard from people.
And Alicia, I mean, you know, if they're private companies, what do we know about the people who are transporting the prisoners? What kind of training do they get?
It seems to be a range of training, but it seems to be pretty minimal in most instances. When we've done this reporting, we've talked to dozens and dozens of people who have worked for these companies. Some people say that they were trained for a couple of days. Some people said they were trained for a couple of weeks. But we've definitely heard from people who felt that they were put onto the van and weren't really ready for the job ahead of them. And this training isn't regulated in any way, so it's really kind of up to the company what they decide that they're going to teach those who are then going to have custody over large numbers of people at times. They operate in sort of this gray area where they have custody of people, but they're not a state entity, they're not a county entity. It's really, like I said, a gray area in our criminal justice system.
All right, let's talk about one group in particular, and this is some of the recent reporting that you had done about this group called USG7, a company which has changed names multiple times, as you pointed out, the focus of your reporting in this recent story. What is this group? Who are these folks?
So USG7 is a company that was registered in Florida in 2009. It was registered by a couple of different people, ultimately ending in a registration of someone named Registered Agents, Inc. And so they were an LLC, and very difficult with the LLC structure to see who actually was the owner of the company. Based on our reporting, the company was operated by a pair of brothers, the Jakes brothers. And at one point, their parents also worked for this company. We know that because in 2010, while the father of the Jakes brothers was driving, he actually got in a crash and died. This company dissolved in 2014. The state of Florida dissolved it for failing to file some paperwork. But during the course of our previous reporting on prison transport companies, we saw USG7 come up in terms of, we saw quite a few accidents that they had been involved in, some quite serious. We saw an escape that was pretty egregious. And they just were one of these small companies that really stood out as having a lot of problems, particularly given how small they were. Eventually, shortly after the USG7 was dissolved by the state of Florida, the Jakes brothers registered a company called U.S. Corrections. Now, according to our reporting, we can see that they've told government entities that they are basically the same company. They use the same equipment, a lot of the same employees. And this all occurred around the time that a particular person we wrote about in our story named Johnny Smith, his family had sued USG7 because he had died aboard one of their vans in 2011.
So, yeah, I mean, U.S. Corrections, again, this what used to be USG7, had faced multiple lawsuits in their original with the original name for injury. One of the instances, this wrongful death of a prisoner, one of those times out of Broward County, a man claims he spent 52 hours inside of a cage in a windowless van. Again, no ventilation, no way to lie down, not enough water. Only, again, as you pointed out, Eli, a bottle to urinate in. How common were these stories, or is this a rarity?
Well, it's hard to say exactly, but based on all of the litigation that we've seen, I mean, we went through and looked at all of the lawsuits against the companies that are in this business, and they're quite numerous. And they're all describing the exact same pattern. And when we've interviewed dozens and dozens of people who have been on these vans, and they're all describing the same conditions. We've interviewed the lawyers who are bringing these lawsuits, and they all describe the same phenomenon. And we've also interviewed dozens of people who have worked for these companies, and they all describe what was happening in the back of their vans in a lot of the same ways. So as far as we can tell, based on the business model of the private prisoner transport industry, these conditions are very common.
I'm talking with Eli Hager and Alicia Santo. They're reporters for the Marshall Project, whose recent investigations look into the private industry of moving prisoners from one state to another. The story was published in the New York Times as well, and you can find out more on our social media at WLRN Sundial. There have been attempts to better regulate this industry. Real quickly, Alicia, what is GINA's Act, and why was it implemented in the first place?
So GINA's Act is the federal government's response to a pretty high-profile escape that happened aboard a prison transport vehicle. So it passed in 2000, and it was based off of a man who escaped from one of these vehicles and was gone for months, and it was on, you know, America's Most Wanted, and it was a very high-profile escape. And so this was sort of the reaction. We need to make a law to regulate these companies, and the law is very much focused on preventing escapes. So it has to do with all prisoners have to be in bright clothing and this many officers per prisoner. So those were the specifics. It does sort of vaguely mention that prisoners should be treated humanely, but there's not a lot of concrete regulation there. So that law passed in 2000. It's still in existence, yet it's only been used once to punish a prison transport company. Again, this was in an escape that happened in 2011. A man escaped from one of these vans and ran into a cornfield. They actually had to harvest the corn to get him out of this field. And that did result in a $10,000 fine, and the company also had to pay the costs of the actual efforts of law enforcement to get this person out of the field. But that is the only time that regulation has ever been used. And other than GINA's Act, the only other regulatory body that oversees prison transport companies is the Department of Transportation. But there's not a special sort of regulation for prison transport companies. They're seen as passenger carriers. So they're in the same group as commercial buses would be in.
And you talk about these escapes, and how many times have prisoners been able to escape?
A lot of times, from what we can see, we were able to count at least 60 escapes, but that's just when a local news story was reported on with it. So if you know, that's just what we can visibly see from news media articles. It's hard to know for sure because no one collects that information exactly how many times it happens.
So U.S. Congressman Ted Deutch spoke with Attorney General Loretta Lynch a few years ago about the concerns that he had with the private prison transportation companies. Here's what he said.
56 prisoners have escaped for-profit transport vehicles. 16 committed new crimes while on the run. And I'll finish just by pointing out a quote from the chief operating officer of one of these companies who said, well, it's regulated by the Department of Justice, but I've never seen anybody come out to actually check on us.
Eli or Alicia, have we seen any changes in Justice Department policy since this testimony almost 3 years ago?
No, I can't say that we have. In response to Congressman Deutsch making that statement, then Attorney General Loretta Lynch promised that the Justice Department would investigate the industry, but the status of that investigation is unclear. Congressman Deutsch, as well as Senators Cory Booker and Elizabeth Warren, recently wrote to Prisoner Transportation Services, which is the largest company that does this, demanding information about their business. So there's still action on Capitol Hill on this issue, but it's not clear that anything in particular has changed, although PTS has promised to install seatbelts and cameras on its vans and that kind of thing. But we continue to see the same lawsuits and the same allegations as we have over the last decade. So it's not clear that anything is changing.
And Congressman Deutsch, of course, representing Broward County, staying in Broward County. You spoke with Broward County Sheriff's Department about their contract with this company, U.S. Corrections. Why are they continuing the relationship despite the concerns that they have about the safety of the services?
So they actually stated to us that they have been aware of the poor record of U.S. Corrections for a long time. They're aware of the death that happened on a U.S. Corrections van, and they're aware of all the other problems that the Marshall Project has documented. But whenever they put out a request for proposals for a new prisoner transport provider, they get very few responses from other companies. And what we've inferred is that the industry is really dominated by PTS and its subsidiary U.S. Corrections, and there just really aren't a lot of other companies that are doing this or that are able to do this. They don't have a full monopoly on the industry, but it kind of operates that way. And that allows them to continue to have contracts with a place like Broward, even though Broward is well aware of their problems.
And Alicia, what are people like Deutsch or Senators Elizabeth Warren or Cory Booker or any of the candidates talking about proposing anything more with regulation of the industry?
Well, the letter they sent to the to Prisoner Transportation Services last month is a series of questions to PTS, and it demands a response. Now, what they'll do with those answers and if they will propose additional regulations on the industry, that's something that we have yet to see if it will happen. So I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see what their responses are and if it becomes something that's a priority to these lawmakers down the road.
Is there anything else, any more reporting on this particular story that either of you are still looking into?
Well, I don't know that we can talk about our ongoing reporting, but I do think that one thing that's important for people listening to be aware of is that, you know, wherever they live, their local jurisdiction might be using one of these companies, and it could be an avenue for local reporting to figure out whether, you know, your county or your state is using a company like PTS, which has been responsible for the kinds of abuses that we've written about. And I think that's kind of the next avenue for people to go down who are interested in these companies.
We've even done a how-to for people to look at themarshallproject.org that just kind of explains how you could find out what company your local jurisdiction is using. And like Eli said, I think it's something really important locally to look at because there's so many places using these companies, and it's very sort of under the radar.
And we will make sure to share that as well in our social media, so people can check that out. Eli Hager and Alicia Santo, reporters for the Marshall Project. Again, their investigation looked into the private industry of moving prisoners from state to state. The story was published again by the New York Times as well, and you can learn more about it at WLRN Sundial on Facebook or Twitter. Eli, Alicia, thank you so much. I appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right, still to come, we're going to lighten things up a little bit and get to poetic because it is National Poetry Month. P. Scott Cunningham of O Miami joins us. Maybe I'll tell some bad poems, too. That's all coming up next here on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez.
Seize the day. Gather ye rosebuds while ye may. Why does the writer use these lines?
Because he's in a hurry.
No. Ding. Thanks for playing anyway.
Oh, that is the great late Robin Williams from one of my all-time favorite movies. P. Scott Cunningham, name that movie.
Dead Poets Society.
Thank you. Absolutely, yes. It's April, which means it is the beginning of National Poetry Month with a series of events planned in partnership with the group O Miami. And yesterday we had on poet Richard Blanco, based here in Miami. He told us one of his favorite stories, by the way, as a teacher, involved a young student who nervously submitted him a poem. And he told the student, quote, "I have good news and bad news. The bad news is you're a poet. The good news is you're a poet." And that student was P. Scott Cunningham, director of O Miami. Cunningham, also the author of the book of poetry, Yate Veo. And he joins us now in studio. Great to have you back, man.
Great to be here.
You remember that story?
No, but that sounds like Richard, yeah.
He was here yesterday. He told us that story. We were all busted out laughing. We thought, oh, this is going to be great. We're going to use that.
Yeah, he was the first person to publish a poem of mine, too. And that it definitely was one of those moments where I was like, oh, I guess I'm going to do this now, aren't I?
What does that mean, by the way? Good news and bad news. You're a poet. But you're a poet.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the bad news is that it's tough to make money doing what you love. The good news is that it's, you know, you can do it your whole life, and it's always challenging, and there's it never gets boring.
I think I'm shooting for worst poet ever. That's my thing. I want to be the worst poet ever. I do write bad poetry. For National Poetry Month, this year, mm-hmm. in one word or a haiku, get Ooh. Creative with me. How do you describe what's going on this year?
Oh man,
you can tell me more than one word. I got to fill time anyway. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, as usual, we're trying to reach every part of Miami. And you know, I think the projects this year are really exciting. I think we have some of the best readings we've ever had at the festival. There's a few young poets who I just think are doing amazing stuff that are going to be in town this month.
Is it about every year? Well, here's the thing. I mean, I wonder if every year you're trying to outdo whatever you've done before. But really, the original goal is to get everybody in Miami-Dade County to experience a poem.
Correct. Yeah.
So I don't know if you're trying to outdo yourself or it's just, have we reached everybody?
No, we definitely haven't reached everybody. You know, we're always trying to do a little bit better than last year, and also trying to reach places that we didn't do year before. And we're always working with new people. We do a call for projects every fall, so the festival is always entirely new because we have new ideas and we have new collaborators. And so that's how we keep it fresh. And every April, it honestly feels like we're doing it for the first time, which is really fun, but also daunting at the same time.
I mean, you think about some of the stuff that you've done, and because it's now what in its eighth year. And you think about all the stuff that you've done. And I mean, you had a parade at what point, you know, the Poetry is Dead parade. Uh-huh. You had poems on rooftops at one point. I know that you also had put some in urinals.
Yes, we have.
So,
yeah.
I mean, you know, so what did you want to do this year that would outdo all that?
So one thing that we're doing, which we're unveiling tomorrow morning, is our first permanent outdoor sculpture, which we've never done before. And it's called Stay Gold, and it's at Robert Asir Farm down in South Dade. And it's by the artist Jesse Knight. So that's something, I mean, we've never attempted anything on that scale.
And Jesse is a local artist.
She is, based in Miami. So that was really exciting.
Tell us about the sculpture, though, real quick.
Sure.
What, I mean, you know, the size, give me the scope here. What am I looking at?
So it's about 12 feet high and 40 feet wide. It's a metal sculpture. It's kind of constructed like you would think the Hollywood sign would be. But it's the color is Dirty Flamingo.
Perfect. Perfect.
And it's really gorgeous because it's actually the way it's built is the sculpture is actually the space around the letters. So the letters themselves are open to the environment. So the light can come through the trees which I think is just really beautiful in conjunction with the letter, you know, the words themselves of Stay Gold.
And how do you have it planned for the, because you're unveiling it tomorrow.
We are, yeah. So it's at 11 a.m. at Robert is here, and we want people to come down and see it. And also we have a limited edition Stay Gold milkshake there.
Nice, wow. So
come hungry.
This is permanent. This is going to be out there.
Yeah. It's hopefully there to stay.
You talked about, you're really excited about this year because of some of the readings that you have going on. So who are the couple of the people, you know, that we should be watching out for?
Absolutely. So this Sunday is a poet named Kaveh Akbar, who's reading in Little Havana, who I just think the world of. On April 19th, we have three of the most talented poets, I think, in the world under 40 years old. There's Jose Olivares, Natalie Centers of Pico, and a British Jamaican poet named Raymond Antrobus. All three are just incredible readers, totally different. But I think anyone who comes to that is going to be blown away and be like, I didn't realize that poetry was this good.
I mean, part of the goal is not just to expose people to poetry, but you want people to get involved as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only way to meet the mission is if people sort of take it on for themselves. I mean, obviously that's what we're trying to do with the Zipodes is, you know, say to people, hey, you can participate. It's easy. You don't have to be an expert or a professor. And a lot of the things that we do are meant to be participatory. Like I have these two flip-flops here with the words "Too Fast, Too Furious" on them. But this was our test case. But so on the morning of April 20th, we're asking people to meet us on Miami Beach. And there's a free pair of flip-flops in it. And there'll be poems on the bottom of the flip-flops. And so we're going to walk up and down the beach and write our own poems in the sand.
I love that. That's awesome. Remind people again, though, how this all started.
Sure.
Where did the idea for the O Miami Festival begin?
So I was a poet and I was lonely. You know, I'd just come out of.
Is that part of what being a poet is? Is just being lonely?
Part of it is.
You have to be? Okay.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, but that's also, you know, part of being a poet is also being in a community. And I think that's the part that doesn't get talked about enough. And part of the reason why I started organizing events was to meet other poets in Miami and be a part of a larger community. And I was writing poems on the street for money in Wynwood.
That's awesome.
During the art walk when Wynwood was very sparse. And the president of the Knight Foundation, Alberto Ibargüen, walked by and I had met him before through this alumni network. And he was like, "What are you doing?" And I told him I was writing poems on the street for money. And he thought that was hilarious. And so we had breakfast and I told him what I wanted to do. And, luckily enough, he thought it might work.
And when you think back to that first year,
yeah.
I mean, what do you think when you look back on that first year?
I had no idea what I was doing. I had no idea what I got myself into. You know, I came up with the mission, you know, first. I mean, I'd never organized anything on the level of a festival, but, you know, I'd done enough readings to know that, you know, I'd probably get, you know, 50 people, you know, to a reading at best. And I really felt like if Knight was, you know, trusting me in this way, I had to do something bigger. I had to try and do something that was, you know, like up to their standards.
Did you envision it get to this point, though?
No,
years later.
No, not at all. I mean, I still feel like, I mean, maybe this is like the writer side of me that's very self-critical, but it still feels to me like nobody cares about it, you know? I just, you know, it's like hard for me to accept that it's a thing. You know, I just always feel like, you know, the dream is going to end tomorrow or something, but it keeps going.
I'm talking with P. Scott Cunningham, founder of O Miami. It is National Poetry Month, and as part of the O Miami Poetry Festival, Cunningham is hoping to expose everybody in Miami-Dade County. You know what? Let's do it throughout South Florida. Get everybody exposed to a poem, to poetry. And you can find more details, by the way, about the events on our social media. Go to WLRN Sundial on Twitter or Facebook. You know, again, thinking about some of the stuff that you've done, I wonder, is there like an ultimate thing you'd like to do that would be like maybe get a poem on the moon and just everybody gets a telescope and we can read it? I don't know. What would be the ultimate thing? Or do you try? Yeah, I don't know, because you're already probably planning next year.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we definitely have some things that we've always wanted to do and haven't been able to pull off for one reason or another. I know one of them is we've always wanted to do something with Publix, but that's like a, for whatever reason.
I know you told me that before. They're not very cooperative, are they?
I don't know. Maybe I just haven't hit the right person yet. I mean, maybe this interview will do it. I don't know. This thing we're trying to do this month, you know, is kind of like a moonshot. We're trying to get Drake to post a poem and tag us in it. You know, I don't know if that's going to happen, but we're trying. So we're asking people to post a favorite poem of yours on social media and tag Drake and tag us and say, "Hey, Drake, it's your turn. Post your favorite poem." I don't know if that's going to work, but it's, you know, in some ways it doesn't matter if it works, because as long as people are posting their favorite poems, I mean, that's the mission, you know.
If you ever do put a poem on the moon, give me credit.
I told you
about it. Let's also, you know, real quickly, because we're doing the Zipodes again this year, and real quickly, because we have a couple of them, we got a couple of entries, and one of them is actually from one of our folks. WLRN's Jessica Bakeman shared her Zipode, and here it is.
Hello, Sundial listeners. I'm Jessica Bakeman, education reporter for WLRN, and I just moved to Miami a year and a half ago. I'm originally from Rochester, New York, and I tell you that because you'll get the sense from my poem that Miami is a new home for me. My zip code is 33137, and this is my zip code. I was wrong when I said home and meant anywhere other than Miami. I found home here.
Zippos has been very popular. And to remind people of how it works, basically you just take the numbers of the zip code, and each line you write as many words as the numbers of that line. So it's 33. Mine is 33186. I still haven't written mine. It's Kendall, so I have to write something about Kendall.
Yeah.
This has been really popular because we've done it more than once.
Yeah, it's been really fun to see. I think people like the challenge of it. You know, people like puzzles. So, ironically, the more restrictive the form that we've done in these things, the more people who want to do it and enter. So, yeah, I mean, I think people like challenges, and they like to write about where they live.
Do you have a zip code right now? Do you have yours? What's your zip code?
Mine is 33138. I don't have one yet. I'm like you. I haven't written mine yet.
He's working on it. Yeah, that's all right. He's working on it. We did get another one from listener Rick Carlin. Sent us his zip code. His zip code is 33304. Here it is.
My name is Rick Carlin from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Two gay men, one tiny dog in Fort Lauderdale. Hashtag love makes a family.
Rick, thank you so much for that. You know what? I'm inspired. I got to get to work and get mine done. And by the way, we'd love to hear from you if you have a zip code. Again, it's just your zip code, and write each line is the number from each line. So it's three letters or three words, zero, because Rick's was 33304. So it's three words, 0 words, 4 words. So write your zip code out and send it to us. We'd like to hear from you. You can write your poem, share it with us at WLRN.org/zip codes. And the deadline, by the way, is April 19th. So think about that. You heard a couple of them. And you know what? I'm going to get mine in there at some point. I'm going to work on mine. Real quickly, Scott, why is poetry still important? I love to ask you this question.
Yeah, no, I know. I love to try and answer it. I'm sure I answer it differently
every time.
I figure
every year you're going to give me a different answer. I know. Yeah.
I mean, I think it's important because it's an art form that everyone can participate in. And it's the only art form I feel like where when I read a poem that I really connect with, I feel like I've gotten inside of the emotional and intellectual state of another person, which otherwise is kind of impossible to do. It's impossible for me to know exactly how someone else is feeling. And really great poems, I think, allow you to do that. And I think that can be a transformative experience. I think it's kind of like the center of what empathy is, you know, and with empathy, then all things are possible.
So, Scott, every time I get you in, I'm going to ask you that question. I'm going to collect every answer that you give me. After a couple of years, I'm going to put that together in a big poem.
Perfect.
That's what it is. P. Scott Cunningham, founder of O Miami. April, again, National Poetry Month. And again, a list of all of the O Miami Poetry Festival festivities. We've got that on our social media. Check it out. A lot of stuff going on. Don't forget, tomorrow, again, is remind everybody about the unveiling of the big sculpture.
Stay Gold unveiling, 11 a.m. at Robert is here tomorrow, Wednesday.
Lots of fun. Always a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
Likewise. Thanks a lot, Lewis.
All right. Still to come, a new play in Miami looks at the story of the famous Cuban rum, and the play will touch on many of your senses. We'll explain that coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, the story and creation of the famous Havana Club rum begins in the late 1870s with the Arechavala family. Now, they first trademarked Havana Club in 1934, and their rum-making business was booming shortly after. Now, things seemed to have been going well until it quickly took a turn during the Cuban Revolution in the late 50s, when the rum was taken out of the family's hands and forced to be handed over to the Cuban government. The legal dispute over who owns the rights to the Havana Club continues to this day in a battle between Bacardi and Pernod Ricard, pitting the U.S. against the Cuban government. In the play, Amparo tells the story of a Cuban exile experience in a 2-hour experiential theatrical experience. I said that right. Let's attendees choose the journey of this story. And it's going to be playing at a private historic residence here in downtown Miami. Cuban-American director Victoria Collado and Cuban-American playwright Vanessa Garcia are the brains behind this amparo, and they join us now. Victoria, Vanessa, it is such a pleasure. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
This is great. This is really fascinating. The performance, again, centers around the Arechavala family. Victoria, first of all, tell us real quickly, who are they?
So the Arechavala family is the family, as you said earlier, that built the Arechavala S.A.A., which is a way of, S.A.A. is like saying incorporated in Cuba. And so they built this company from the ground up. And with that, they built the town. They were part of building the town of Cárdenas, Cuba, which was a major port for rum at that point.
And what was the premise? That's the premise that they're the center of this play. But what is the premise of this play? They're the main character, but what is the premise of this play?
The premise of this play is really to show people what it was like to go through the revolution in Cuba at that time. I think we've heard this story before multiple times. Everybody who's lived in Miami before or has met a Cuban exile knows this story, or knows the story of leaving everything behind and moving forward. But I think that the premise is to open up the Arechavala story to everyone around so that they can come in and experience it themselves.
You know, Vanessa, I mean, you know, there's so many ways to tell the story. I mean, it's true, as Victoria said, the story's been told so many different ways. But why this family? What was the inspiration?
Well, I think this family represents the story of many, many Cuban families, but not only Cuban families. The name of the play is called Amparo, which is one, the name of the wife of our central character and is herself a central character, Amparo Arechavala. But the word itself means refuge. And I think there are a lot of people around the world right now that can relate to what it means to seek refuge or be a refugee. And I think there is a 21st century crisis in it. So it's in a refugee crisis. And so I think it speaks to a lot of people, anyone who has ever loved and lost a place, who has had to move, cross borders.
And to have something taken away, because, I mean, this correct. Was a family that had created something so big and so important, and it's yanked from them.
Yes, absolutely. They had created it, as you said earlier, since 1878. This is, you know, 19th century, working at it through storms and through generations. And then all of a sudden there's a knock on the door and the company is stolen with no recompense. And not only that, but the story itself was erased. And so the idea of bringing to light a story that has been erased and lifting a veil, I think, is something that we're definitely doing.
So the first scene of the show starts at a party. Mm-hmm. Tell us how things now unravel from that point.
Yes. So there are five entry points to this party. They are the five, when you go and buy a ticket online, you'll see that there are different characters. So there's Celia, which is we call the very, very hot track. And we have Miguel, which is representative of time, for example. They're all representative of the rum-making process, but really they're just people. They're people and points of views. It's like when you go to a party and everybody sees the same party, but you're all having a different experience because you're standing in a different place or a different spot with a different group of people. And so what we're showing is different points of view, and you move with those characters throughout the entire journey. And as the journey progresses and as this party takes place, you start to see the history of the Arechavala family from 1957 through 2019.
And, you know, Victoria, the other thing, too, is that people, the audience, I said experiential. This is like, it's not sit back and watch. You're kind of taking part in it.
Yes, you are a vital part of the story. And so what we've crafted along with our scenic designer, Joe Rada, and our designers, a sound designer, Abby Nover, and our lighting designer, Tyler Frank, is that we're messing with your senses, if you will. And so we're constantly placing you and making sure that smell, sight, sound, everything puts you into the moment of the story. And then we started messing with what choice is. I think that something that's very important in this play and in the way that we've crafted it is that we want to make sure that the audience is an active member of being part of the story. Sometimes in immersive theater pieces, some people are flies on the wall and you kind of take a peek in to the story, but here you are integral and you have to make choices in order to see how you want to see the story.
So in a way, the audience, it's kind of, I was thinking, is it like a choose your own adventure? I'm choosing what could happen next.
Well,
sort of.
The story is what it is.
It is what it is, right.
But you choose how you get to see that story.
How I see it, exactly. Interesting. All right. And the other thing, too, is the space that this takes place in. Not your typical theater with a stage, mm-hmm. and I'm behind the fourth wall. It's in a residence, in a famous residence.
Yes, it's in a home that I believe has been around, right, Vane, from 1919.
Yep.
And what's wonderful about our designers is that they've crafted it off of what the house is already, what the house already naturally has, and so we've taken the beauty of what we walked into that space and we fell in love immediately. And so we've just crafted everything around there, and there's walls that you're going to see that weren't there before. And
so as a member of the audience, I'm coming in. How am I going to, you know, again, is it room to room? And this is a two-story building. So it's, I mean.
We take you all over the house. We take you. There is no going. There's like train versions where you go room by room and you get the piece of the story. We turn the same room around 5 times.
Yeah.
And
I should add that every single person that goes to see the show will see the central story, no matter where they're standing or which route they chose. There is no wrong route. There's no wrong character to choose. They're all equally fun and good. And you just have to go in with an open heart and ready to jump in, because you'll be guided.
And as you said, it's going to use more of your senses than you are used to using watching a show.
Absolutely. This is active theater. It's not sitting down in a proscenium and just watching and then having some sort of catharsis later, right? You're sort of going through it in the moment.
I'm talking with Cuban-American director Victoria Collado and Cuban-American playwright Vanessa Garcia, the brains behind the show called Amparo. And again, as we've been hearing, not the show you, it's not in a theater. You're not sitting, you're participating, you're making choices, and you're not just seeing and hearing things. You're going to smell things too. I mean, it's a little bit of a lot of things. It's a fascinating idea. The show, by the way, opens April 4th. It's at the Private Historic Villa in downtown Miami. We have information on our social media that you can check out, and check out some of the photos and see some of the details on our social media at WLRN Sundown. Really fascinating. This show started as a 20-minute show at a bar in New York, Victoria?
So it actually started as a 20-minute pilot, and Vanessa was approached by Paul Ramirez. And do you want to tell that part of the story, V?
Sure. I got a phone call from Paul Ramirez of Team Enterprises, and he says, you know, we hear you write about Cuba, and we hear that you're also a playwright, and would you be interested in doing this 20-minute show at a bar about this family? So I looked up the family and brought in Victoria, and all of a sudden that 20-minute show really did become a 2-hour pilot production in New York, in Miami first, and then in New York, and now it's this semi-permanent show.
And a little bit about that process. I mean, how you go from a 20-minute pilot to this very, I mean, again, there's a lot of wheels turning in this show.
Absolutely. This is a show, I think, that is completely mission-driven, and everybody involved in the show is so passionate about it that there's no way that passion could fit in 20 minutes. That's one way to say it. But
and another thing is that I think that this kind of storytelling forces you to work in total collaboration with every artist. So it's not just like, you know, Vanessa writes the play and then it's done, and then, you know, I go direct it and then the actors learn their lines. No, it's constantly, we're still living and breathing in. Every detail has come into play, and so you're forcing a group of people to really become one in order to tell the story as truthfully and as great as possible.
Now, this is, again, it's a story of this family. It's also the story of the Havana Club Rum, which they're also presenting the play, right? When did they become part of this?
From the beginning. They have been a part of it from the beginning, and I actually think I have never had more freedom, and I think we could say we, in this, we have never had more freedom in the creation process. This has been a fascinating journey where, you know, we have been learning about certain parts of their business, and they've been learning about playwriting and about directing, and it's just become this really wonderful, beautiful collaboration. So from the start, and I think it's a brave choice and an intelligent choice.
I wondered if, you know, because we had mentioned at the beginning that there's still dispute about who owns this. Does that still play a role? Because, you know, you're telling this long story, this long history of the family. Does that still part of it?
Well, what the Amparo experience shows you is the story behind the brand. And we welcome people to come in and to learn about it, and then they can make their own decisions.
There are 23 actors in the show, 4 musicians, 2 dancers. It's a lot of people. What was the selection process like?
So this Alexa, we went through audition process first, very normal. Actors came in, did their monologues. But I think that what we really were focused on, one thing that was very vital to us is that there was some connection to Cuba. You didn't have to be Cuban fully, but you had to have some sort of connection.
All
with
the
Cuba.
Performers have some connection.
Some sort of connection to Cuba. And it was also important to us that they knew how to work as together as a team. So a lot of our callbacks were people in groups together making stuff up. And every callback, we always got someone with a weird face, like, what's happening here? We're like, what is this? But what was great is that we found some really wonderful people who have given, I can never repay them for the amount of love and hard work they've put in.
I wanted to ask both of you this question. It's an interesting story in South Florida, the Cuban experience. I'm seeing it from the outside, but is that depending on who you talk to, you know this, you tell me, you know, you talk to the older generations, they have a very different story, especially if they are the ones who had to try and escape. And then that story changes from generation to generation. And I'm wondering, you know, what you've seen in you know, those younger generations who've never been to Cuba. They've heard the stories, but they're disconnected. Is the story disappearing?
I think that the story is actually becoming more alive. Mm-hmm. I think that, and Vanessa can chime in more here, but I think that there's something, and we were experiencing it with our actors. They were disconnected for a bit, and then you come in here, and this story is vital because it has brought them to ask their families questions, and now they carry it in a different way. I think that,
And I think we're also, I mean, we say this a lot, but I think we are a bridge generation, which means that we have the ability to understand our parents and grandparents and hear that story, and then also understand what it means to speak to an American and global public. And so that idea of taking that story and kind of translating it into something that then can be heard, I think is really important to every single person in this cast who feels, as Victoria said, even more connected, I think, to the story.
Yeah, we've come to, as a group, to understand that what the Cuban people have gone through on the island or outside is trauma. And so in order to speak about that, we have to make an open space where all voices are heard, but they do need to be funneled, not by screaming, not by yelling, but by opening up in the story and opening it up to people who have never heard it before.
And so the audiences will get to experience that story in this show.
Yes.
It's a vital part of the story.
That's the only way to tell the story.
The story does all the work.
What else would you tell audiences how to prepare for this kind of experience?
You have to wear flat shoes.
I was going
to
say, wear comfortable shoes. Please, please wear comfortable shoes.
Have zero expectations.
Ride share.
Just come in to just enjoy the ride. We always make the joke that it's like we've built a little Disney World, if you will, and we just want people to come and join us on the ride and just go spend an hour and a half with us and then think about what's happening.
Have fun.
Yeah.
It again, as we've said, this is a show where you're not passively watching. You are actively you're involved in it. You're going to be using more senses than you may be used to. You're going to be able to participate in a way, and it is a fascinating story because no two people are going to see it the same way. I get talking with Cuban-American director Victoria Collado and Cuban-American playwright Vanessa Garcia collaborating on this play, Amparo, and it is playing. It starts Thursday, April 4th, and again, it's at a private historic villa here in downtown Miami. We'll have more details on our social media, WLRN Sundance, so you can check it out. Really, really interesting. Victoria, Vanessa, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you
for having
and
us.
And to the performers, break a leg and enjoy that. Well, that's our program for today, this Tuesday, April 2nd. Again, you can always learn more about any of the segments that we've done by finding us on Facebook at WLRN Sundock. Remember, we always love to hear from you, any of your thoughts about the program, or if you've got some ideas about what's going on in your community. We'd love to hear from you. Again, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. You can always go back and listen to old shows by going to WLRN.org. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.